Well, as Tony mentioned, I think two parts, but we'll see how we go. I hope you find this interesting. It is a bit of a speculative meandering, but I think you'll find it hopefully quite relevant to your own, to forming your own views about God and the world we live in. Provocatively, I've called it Sin Sum, part one, which I'm sure is very obscure, but I hope that term will become apparent as we go on. It's a Jewish term, and it was developed by Jewish rabbinic philosophers probably from about the 10th century and reached its peak around the 15th century in Europe. I think it probably borrows a bit from the Greeks. It borrows a lot from their own tradition and their own delving into the nature of God from their reading of the scriptures. And I'm using it as a framework to hang a speculative study on what God is doing here in creating the world, why he created it, what's his purpose, where is it all going. And I think one thing's for certain, it's not simple. The world is not a simple place. It is a very complicated place. And I'd like to start in Job chapter 21, which is a great passage of absolute complaint by Job. He's listened endlessly to his companions giving him trite answers to this very sophisticated world we live in. They've looked for linear, simple, one-to-one relationships that can explain Job's predicament. And I might just read it if I could, or bits of it. I'll start at verse 7. Why do the wicked live on, growing old and increasing in power? They see their children established around them, their offspring before their eyes. Their homes are safe and free from fear. The rod of God is not on them. Their bulls never fail to breed. Their cows calve and do not miscarry. They send forth their children as a flock. Their little ones dance about. They sing to the music of timbrel and lyre. They make merry to the sound of the pipe. They spend their years in prosperity and go down to the grave in peace. And just jumping on he goes and complains. And then verse 23, one person dies in full vigor, completely secure and at ease, well nourished in body, bones rich with marrow. Another dies in bitterness of soul, never having enjoyed anything good. And he says, this is not just a local problem, right? This is a problem right throughout the earth. In verse 29, he says, have you never questioned those who travel? You just ask anybody. Ask somebody from China. Ask somebody from America. Have you paid no regard to their accounts? That the wicked are spared from the day of calamity, that they are delivered from the day of wrath. It's complicated. There is no simple religious view that can encapsulate what is going on here in the world. In his last lament, his last verse, so how can you console me with your nonsense? Nothing is left of your answers but falsehood. And I think the problem for us with religion is it tends to be a very trite one-for-one attempt to answer very complex questions, an attempt to grapple with an incredibly sophisticated, rich and profound world. And of course Job, I think Job brings that out very well here. So the KISS principle just doesn't work in religion. You can't keep it simple, stupid, right? You don't have, simple religion just looks for a simple linear relationship. It's the one that we tend to grow up on. Cause and effect, disobedience equals punishment, obedience equals reward, love equals kindness, but wrath is going to give you suffering. For Job, this is nothing but nonsense and falsehood. He thought that's how the world operated. All his companions are telling him how the world is operating, but in fact, he's listened for days and days. He just thinks it's all nonsense, what they're telling him. Does anyone sort of relate to that? So I'm going to speculate that the project we call life does not equal the favourite Christian one, reward and punishment. That simple equation, reward and punishment, it's very brutish, simplistic, unsubtle, unsophisticated, unimaginative. It's kind of painting a picture of an incredibly one-dimensional character of God. Like, we could do better than that. We do have to do better than that, in fact, because the first relationship we ever get is a family relationship, and that does not work, that simple principle. It is a very, very bad way to run a family. So what is the project we call life? Well, I think God is taking us from innocence to wisdom. That is the whole project that's going on here. That's why. And God, I'm going to go on and talk about how God has created this space, this environment, this arc, which we call the current age on the earth, where this journey can happen for us from innocence to wisdom. And wisdom is, of course, caring. It's complex, it's subtle, sophisticated, it's very imaginative. If you want to be wise in a family environment, if you're a parent and you want to bring up your children, you need a lot of wisdom. Reward and punishment is one of the last tools in your toolkit. It's the last one you want to resort to, really. It's interesting too, like I've mentioned there, that the Garden of Eden account is a good mirror of the family, because what happens in, of course, is Adam starts off very innocent. He's innocent, then he's confronted by the knowledge of good and evil, and he suddenly loses his innocence and has to make his way in the world, which is, of course, the same experience that we have with our children. As soon as, while they're still young, we almost keep them in a garden environment. We protect them. We absolutely eliminate all sorts of decision-making from their lives. We make all those decisions for them. We protect them and so on and so forth. But as soon as we know the time is coming, 12, 13, 14, our daughter is 12. She's about to head into that. We've seen two already go that way. But that's when you sort of take a bit of an intake of breath as a parent, you know. Uh-oh, it's about to start. They're going to confront this complex world that we are no longer going to be able to protect them from. They're going to go outside the garden. How are we going to transition them from that closed environment, that protected environment, into the world that we know is a very, very complicated, very oftentimes unfriendly place?
Yes. I just throw a little observation to go back. Yep. I know you're going to talk about the trees.
Yep.
And the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So I thought I should be good and do a John Wald check on the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life in ancient literature. Mm-hmm. So I did on his Bible commentary. And the tree of the knowledge of good and evil has no shadows whatsoever. You know, it seems a complete innovation, whole story, and the tree of life, pretty much the same. Possible a few tenuous links, but this idea of the two trees, the whole choice structure, seems completely unique. I found it to be, mm-hmm. as you talked tonight, right?
Yes. Well, I'm glad you said that. That means I can be completely speculative.
That's about right. it's a flagship.
Some may say heretical. Thank you. So we as Christians, though, I think have inherited a very harsh view of God. God who is the old, we tend to think of the Old Testament view of God. We call it the Old Testament view. I don't believe that the Old Testament view of God is harsh, but we seem to like, as human beings, taking the harsh aspects out of it and magnifying those and focusing on this simple linear relationship that God is holy. We're obviously not. Consequences, bad things follow. But the Jewish, I think, steeped in the Jewish literature, and the Old Testament particularly, right at the beginning of the Old Testament, is this real complex relationship God has with his people, where he is obviously a holy God, and he is obviously all-powerful, and he could wipe him out in a minute, but yet there's a tremendous restraint happening. He's absolutely holding himself back from exercising those aspects of his character which we tend to focus on overly much. And I'd like to just read, I think it first appears very strongly in the Exodus account, firstly against Egypt, when the Jews are coming out of Egypt. The Egyptians certainly feel a good right-hand whack from God. I think the Bible calls it the finger of God, so you'd hate to think what it would be if he took a real swing at them. But then he starts dealing with his people, with the Jews, and I just read a bit from Exodus 19 and following. They've settled at the base of the mount. They're ready to worship God. Moses has told them we're going to go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and worship God there. So Moses tells them, put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, be careful that you do not approach the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain is to be put to death. They are to be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on them. No person or animal shall be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they may approach the mountain. So the big barriers have been put up around the mountain. Don't go near it. If you do, the instruction is you have to be killed, but the person who kills you is not even allowed to touch you, because then they get contaminated in the same way. You have to remain completely away from this mountain. On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain. Just imagine you're standing there and you're watching all this kind of unfolding. It's very descriptive. It's physical. There's a physical phenomenon that they're describing happening here. There's not some spiritual, I felt this spiritual presence, you know. This is a very physical, brutal kind of environmental effect. A very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently. As the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. Then jumping down, "Go down and warn the people so they do not force their way through to see the Lord, and many of them perish. Even the priests who approach the Lord must consecrate themselves, or the Lord will break out against them." I want to emphasize, the Lord will break out against them. You can just feel God has withdrawn behind this barrier that he's put up around Sinai. He's contained himself there. If you go in there, you're going to get completely consumed. So long as you stay beyond the barrier, you're going to be okay. And then it goes on to say, "But the priests and the people must not force their way through to come up to the Lord, or he will break out against them." Emphasizes that again. Then in 20 he goes on, "When the people saw the thunder and lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance and said to Moses, 'Speak to us yourself and we will listen, but do not have God speak to us or we will die.'" And then down the bottom, "Moses approached the thick darkness where God was." So you're getting, I mean, I'm sure you've all read this passage many times before, and I'm emphasizing a particular part of it. Because what I think what's happening here is you're getting a dual story in this whole passage of Exodus. You're getting the very cold, sterile giving of the law. Well, it's not cold and sterile, I'm sorry, that's not fair. But this very forensic giving of the law, you know. All the commandments are given, and then it jumps. Well, what's happened? Then the narrative kicks in again. Then you're down to, oh, the tabernacle is, you know, you do this with the tabernacle, you do that with the priestly garments, and then you go, oh, and then there's another narrative interjection happening. And you're bouncing between the two. Because, of course, straight after this, it goes on to the giving of the Ten Commandments, or the Ten Words, I should say. So we've gone down, come back down, we've got the Ten Words. I think there was a bit about the, you know, servant gets the oil in the ear, and a few other things happen then. And then we're jumping up again. Lord said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. You are to worship at a distance. You're to worship at a distance. But Moses alone is to approach the Lord, and the others must not come near, and the people may not come up with him." And then, so anyway, the elders went up. "Under his feet was something like a pavement made of lapis lazuli, as bright blue as the sky. But God did not raise his hand against these leaders of the Israelites. They saw God, and they ate and drank." Pretty cute way of saying they lived, you know. They went through this incredible experience, but they came down and they had it. They were still able to eat and drink. Then jumping down the bottom, "When Moses went up on the mountain, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai. For 6 days the cloud covered the mountain, and on the seventh day the Lord called to Moses from within the cloud. To the Israelites, the glory of the Lord looked like a consuming fire on top of the mountain. Then Moses entered the cloud as he went on up the mountain." All very well-known passages in this one also. The tent of meeting. A very strange phenomenon. So we've come to, we get a whole lot more laws. We're talking about, I think here's where you talk about the tabernacle and the priestly garments. And then now, it just gives you this little interjection. "Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you because you are a stiff-necked people and I might destroy you on the way." Okay. Now Moses used to take a tent and pitch it outside the camp some distance away, calling it the tent of meeting. Anyone inquiring of the Lord would go to the tent of meeting outside the camp. And whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people rose and stood at the entrance to their tents, watching Moses until he entered the tent. As Moses went into the tent, the pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke with Moses. Whenever the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance to the tent, they all stood and worshipped, each at the entrance of their tent. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as someone speaks to a friend. Then Moses would return to the camp, but his young aide Joshua, son of Nun, would not leave the tent. And then, of course, the very famous passage where, in verse 18, Moses said, "Show me your glory." You wonder what Moses thought he'd seen up until that point, you know. Obviously wasn't enough. He wanted more. He wanted, "I want the real thing now. I want to actually see you." And I think that's the implication. "I've seen your works. I've seen your finger. I want to see you. Show me your glory. Show me, I want to see God." And then there's a very strange reply. "And the Lord said, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But he said, you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live." Then the Lord said, there is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen. Now, I'm sure you've all heard many sermons preached on this passage, or at least taking up parts of sermons. Clearly, it's trying to show that there's two interesting things that I just like to highlight here. Firstly, there's about three levels of cascading down before Moses actually gets to see God. You know, he's gone from the glory to the backside, and he's put his hand over the top, and then finally he'll get a glimpse, right? So it's very clearly trying to show that this many times removed before Moses can actually see something and still eat and drink like the elders of Israel. And secondly, at that point, God chooses to specify. He does give Moses a little bit of an insight into who he is. And what aspects does he choose to mention? He chooses to mention that he's merciful and he has compassion. That's the two things he wants. God himself wants to highlight about his character at that point. Now, obviously, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about these passages, but it's nothing compared to what the Jews do. You know, once the rabbis get hold of something, they just go at it and go at it and go at it. They analyze every little bit and piece of it, and they've had thousands of years to do it, because we kind of got sidetracked off the Old Testament by the New Testament, and it sort of reinterpreted the whole Old Testament for us, whereas the rabbis haven't had any distraction like that. All they do is just drill down and down and down and down into the Old Testament only. So they have to try and make assessments about God based on these passages only. That's their primary source material. And that's why I've gone into some detail, because this is where they're very busy, you know, they're busy with these sort of passages all the time. And over, you know, they'd be busy with the way the Israelites camped around about the tabernacle. How often can we enter the tabernacle? We've got to go through the sacrifices to enter the tabernacle. So then there's the Holy of Holies. So God is with us, but in what sense is he with us? What's his real nature? What conclusions can we draw about his actual nature from these speculations? And of course, what on earth is the cherubim? You know, that I'm sure you can have, you know, you have a lot of fun with the cherubim, and they do, you know, talk endlessly about this sort of thing. You know, he dwells between the cherubim. That's a psalm. David obviously speculated about, or whoever wrote Psalm 99. These are all things that they're busy speculating about. And of course we do too. In Hebrews it says we cannot speak, you know. He touches on this and he says, oh no, we can't speak particularly about this at the moment, unfortunately. So I think around 1000 AD, as I said, the Jewish, if you understand the history of the Jews, which you probably all do pretty, I'm sure you all do up until the point of coming of Christ, you know, the destruction of the first temple, the exile, the coming of the exiles back into Israel, rebuilding the second temple, then the Maccabees throughout the Greeks, but then the Romans came in and took over, and then they conquered Israel. Herod rebuilt or renovated the second temple to make it, you know, this big deal. And then it was destroyed, and the Jews were scattered and dispersed, silenced. Well, for the Jews, that's of course a very big point in history, but they had this whole community, enormous community, very productive community still in Babylon, and they developed a very deep philosophic tradition. All their best thinkers actually were over in Babylon. And that's where the Talmud came from. It's the Babylonian Talmud. All their learning was preserved and, of course, generated over there. And right throughout the period of the return in Israel, the Babylonian community was actually the authoritative community rather than the one in Israel. So there's an unbroken line of Jewish philosophers going on for hundreds, even thousands of years, up to 1,000 years probably, when the Kabbalists really started to write a lot of literature, the Zohar and all those sort of Jewish mystical books. Are you familiar with those books? Anyway, it's a very strong tradition, Jewish philosophy, theosophy, you know, the philosophical study of God and his nature. I think Christians, of course, all of their attention, of course, now, all Christian philosophy is Christology. That's where we spend all our time and focus. And Christology, you know, it's a very philosophical pursuit also. It's just, you know, the nature of the Trinity, all these sort of things. You can buy thousands of books on it. The Jews, of course, don't go down that path at all. They're on a different path. And Tzimtzum is where their thinking has come to. Tzimtzum is the Jewish response. Christology is the Christian response. Tzimtzum is the Jewish response to what is the nature of God and what is he doing in the creation. Everybody following that? So we're going to have a look at that, because I think it's very interesting to contrast the two. I'll be talking about Christology next talk, but I want to set it up by talking about Tim Sum this talk, because I think you'll see one leads very nicely into the other, and that there's a lot of similarity between the two, because ultimately, if you're studying the Old Testament, it should be able to get you quite a long way towards an understanding of who God really is. What we've just read in Exodus, there's no doubt that it's talking about a pretty powerful, like a powerful God. I think we can all understand the Jews came to a point where they realized that they had a very sophisticated understanding of what it must be like to be God, omnipotent, all-powerful, eternal, all these sort of things. And all-consuming, I think, is one aspect that we get from the passages we just read in Exodus, and very destructive if not contained. And I think a good metaphor of that is the sun. And the Jewish mystical writings often use the sun as a metaphor for God. Very brutal, unsubtle, undifferentiated, unsophisticated. That is God unrestrained, completely unrestrained. God who fills the whole universe, who actually is so powerful and so all-consuming that there is no room for a universe at all to exist. And we can imagine, they speculate, they use the sun as a very good example. If you start to approach the sun very quickly, you're going to get consumed by it. Just like the metaphor in the Exodus account that we read. If you want to remain alive, if you want to still be able to eat and drink, you have to keep distance from God. You can't approach his presence directly. Lots of metaphors come out from the sun. Like, the sun is a very, in essence, we know now, the sun is a very simple structure. It's protons being converted into a few more protons. It's a hydrogen atom being converted into a helium atom, right? It's very undifferentiated. It's a very unsophisticated structure. But it releases immense energy. There's no differentiation in the sun. You know, there's no subtlety. Oops. That's why we have so much trouble with a nuclear fusion reactor. Nuclear energy is derived from what we call nuclear fission, which is it's a kind of nuclear power that is very easy to contain. Nuclear fusion, on the other hand, which is what goes on in the sun, is so powerful that it dissolves any matter, so nothing can actually contain it. And I think it's a very good metaphor for, again, for God. There's no way that you can imagine a structure that can contain nuclear fusion. The only thing, the speculation is we've got to do it by energy. We've got to do it by magnetic fields. It's the only way that you can contain this immense power within nuclear fusion. And I'm hoping you're seeing parallels here between what I read in Exodus and this kind of metaphor. Strangely enough, though, right next door, you just go 130 million miles down the road, and you have this, which is a very differentiated, very subtle, very sophisticated entity. So something is constraining and containing the power of the sun. You can imagine here the Israelites and the sun. So the earth to the sun is the same as the Israelites to Mount Sinai. There's some sort of containment mechanisms built into the universe that allows subtle differentiation. You know, in some parts there's brutal energy, other parts there's benign, gentle, easy space to exist in. And our solar system, I think, is a very good example. So from this sort of speculation, the rabbis came up with a very Kantian view, in my opinion. They said all that brutal kind of energy stuff, that's above the line here, and God keeps it separate. He knows we can't survive in the presence of that, in the presence of that manifestation of himself. And that part of me, that's his essence. And in the Jewish writings, it's called the Ein Sof, just literally means limitless or no end. That's the, Christians would call that God the Father in some sense, I suppose, in his pure form. Nothing can exist in the presence of the Ein Sof. It just gets dissolved into nothingness. In order to create the world, God has to extend himself below the line. He has to create a space away from this undifferentiated characteristic of himself. And he emanates out various attributes of his character. Well, character starts to become differentiated within God, the rabbis speculate. And these are called his emanations. I'll just stop and say I don't agree with this, but I think it's a very interesting... Everything's an anthropomorphism here, okay? These are human speculations about things that are really beyond our knowledge. But if you just bear with me and follow me down this line a bit, I think you'll get some interesting insights from it. Another way of drawing that, so these emanations go out from here. This is kind of, the blast radius. If you like, you know what I mean? And then beyond it, you can start to have some sort of survival. But inside there, you're inside the blast radius.
I won't go into...
Beyond that are these emanations, which are the distillation of differentiable aspects of God's character. And this is what they look like. And this is a very interesting, I think, construct that the rabbis have come up. What they've chosen to pick out, here you have bina, understanding. That's something that, this becomes an expression of the mind of God and the character of God and why he created the world. Over on this side, chokhmah is wisdom. Down here you have gevura, severity. Over this side, chesed is kindness. Over here, you've got splendor or glory. But on this side, that's that victory, but really long-suffering endurance. All these kind of aspect remain in balance. God needs both aspects in order to make the world. He needs might and power, but he also needs kindness and gentleness. He needs the sun, but he also needs to find a place for the earth. He needs to have, if you put all these four together, you end up in the middle with beauty, symmetry, balance. And what they speculate is, you've got this aspect here of God's character, severe, powerful, you've got another aspect, very kind, and then the two have to be kept in balance down through the middle, and God keeps them in perfect balance so that his purposes can be fulfilled, but at the same time we can all eat and drink at the same time. We're not consumed. And they all flow down. This is called the tree of life in rabbinic philosophy, and down to Malkut means kingship. It's also the Shekinah, which is referred to in Jewish mystical literature. And that is the creation. It's also, here's Greek, all Greek flowed into this, but it all sort of flows down into the creation. Here's the mind of God, keeping it all in balance, planning it in eternity, and then it comes down, crystallized and expressed in a perfectly balanced way in the creation.
Ron, just to kind of back that up, the whole structure is dialectical, so it's a series of paradoxes.
Exactly.
Which are only resolved by a third way, so close to Christ. Yes. And I guess that literary structure we've alluded to in the Old Testament of the chiastic structure, very many psalms have chiastic structure of paradoxes that they get resolved. So that this thinking is actually quite a lot in the Old Testament.
Yes.
Literary structure well below in the style.
Yeah. In fact, I think the rabbis are at pains to point out that paradox is at the heart. From a human point of view, it seems complete paradox. The aspect and nature of God and the way he's created the world and how it all functions, it all operates in paradox.
Just by way of parallel, in Second Road, we pursue the nature of creativity and we're just constructing a major course for health, but essentially that's it. It's the essence of creativity is non-linear relation. We have other consulting firms and other people try to get creativity with step one, a linear relationship, step one, step two. It never works, but we have honed this. I've had to cover these walls up as a major publicly listed company trying to think of new ways forward. Essentially, we just play with paradox, play with paradox, play with paradox and stuff. There's deep, absolutely practical wisdom here of what it is to be a king in any situation. You can't handle that, you get
it. Yep. Right, when I was in Israel, we actually saw a model of the tree of life. It made absolutely no sense to me then, it does now. But I couldn't see anything. It was actually a very confused, serenely confused, it made absolutely no sense. But when you use the same word, tree of life,
Obviously, the rabbis have conveniently fit everything into 10 aspects. Probably they think there's some sort of mystical significance to that. But I think the key is what you're saying, Tony. You've got this opposite, paradoxical, binary or tertiary or even beyond that system, all of which is balancing and in perfect harmony. And you need that, otherwise you can't make the world and rule the world properly. This is another. So you said these are the three pillars. The left pillar is justice, the right pillar is mercy, and the centre pillar is mildness. And of course, Christology is all over right through there. But the Jewish mind has distilled these aspects out of the Old Testament. And what they've come to is that God has had to withdraw himself and to make space for the creation, and they call that simsum. That is, the translation of simsum is concealment or contraction. God is not able to show Like he can't just show, he can't just manifest this as, there's no room for creation, there's no room for other creatures, that's all God is doing. By the same token, he can't really rule any, just God, that is personnel on show. There's got to be this sophisticated, interrelated, very complex personality at work in the creation. And So I come back to my original point, you know, that when Job is searching for answers, he's getting probably just this here, going, oh, look, this is what it is, you know. This is the justice. God's meeting out his justice on Paul. If they're feeling in a good mood, they must talk all about mercy. But to get the answer right, you've got to do the whole thing. And that's of course, what is happening here somehow. It's a very complicated, interrelated, profound system that God has working in this creation. Everybody happy with that? Sorry?
The Psalms.
Yeah, the Psalms are really big on all this sort of thing. Yeah. So, of course, when we say God is concealed or contracted, they're not saying he's gone, he's absent. It's that he's suppressing aspects of his personality, mainly the power, justice side, so that other aspect can become visible to us. You know, you can't manifest mercy and kindness if you just got the loudspeaker going all the time. You know, everything has to, you got to dial everything down to a more muted level so that everything can start, you can hear a symphony. You know, you can't just, in a symphony, you can't just have one instrument on the amplifier and the rest just playing without it. You've got to, everything has to be dialed down and everything has to play its part. And this is what the Jewish concept of God's character is. There's you know, infinite aspects to his character that all have to be functioning at a level that we can deal with. Now, this is from everything came to a head in the 1700s with this book, which is the Tanya. It's basically the compilation of the Jewish mystical writers. Very interesting, but very difficult book. You need rabbis to take you through it, otherwise you just have no chance of understanding it. But I've just given here an aspect of, just one section of it, which I think draws out some of this aspect of Tzimtzum. I'll just read it. And just as it is impossible for the mind of any creature to apprehend his attributes of Gedulah, greatness, which is the ability to create a being out of nothing and give it life, as it is written, the world is built by, i.e. created through the attribute of kindness. You see, they're saying greatness and kindness are the same thing here. It goes on to explain. Exactly so, it is impossible for it to apprehend the divine attribute of might, restraint, which is the faculty of Tzimtzum, condensation or contraction, restraining the spreading forth of the life force from his attribute of Gedulah or greatness. So you've got this two aspects of greatness. One is, you've got the one side where it spreads forth in an all-consuming fashion. But on the other hand, what's an even greater greatness is the ability to contain that immense power. It's the analogy of the fusion reactor, you know. The easy part is making the fusion happen. The hard part is then containing it and making it useful and benign and a source of energy. You can make a hydrogen bomb very easily, but you can't make a hydrogen nuclear reactor, because then you have to constrain it all. And the constraining power has to be actually greater than the exploding power. You understand what I'm saying? So this is what it's arguing here. Preventing it from descending upon and manifesting itself to the creatures and providing them with life and existence in a revealed manner, but rather with his countenance concealed, i.e. the divine activating force is at work within creation in a concealed manner. Now, I'm hoping that your minds are, of course, racing through the New Testament, thinking about all sorts of passages which hint at this kind of thing. And I won't go into them this time, but we'll look at a lot of those passages in the New Testament next time, God willing. Thus it is the attribute of might or greatness or power, and Tzimtzum, even more might and greatness and power, the power that restrains the power, in other words. Tzimtzum is the power that restrains the power, that enables the life force to be concealed from the very creature is creating. For the life force conceals itself in the body of the created being, making it appear as if the body of the created being had independent existence, and making it appear as though the created being was not merely an extension of the life force and spirituality that creates it. I'm not sure if I agree with all of this. But anyway, just to give you a taste, just like the diffusion of the radiance of the light of the sun, but an independently existing entity. Although in reality, the created being has no independent existence and is only like the diffusion of the light from the sun. Here, this sun metaphor, you see, they use that a lot in mystical writing. Nevertheless, this nullification is not felt by created beings, even though they are but a diffusion of God's activating force. For this capacity for self-concealment is the very restraining power of the Holy One. Blessed be he who is omnipotent. God's omnipotence expresses itself not only in his ability to bring forth light and bestow life, but also in his ability to conceal this same light and life from the beings he creates, and hence able to condense the life force and spirituality which issues from the breath of his mouth, and to conceal it, so that the body of the created being shall not become nullified out of existence. And hence, notwithstanding the fact that the created being is but a diffusion of the rays of its source, it is thus enabled to perceive itself to be an independently existing entity. So, you know, it's implying if God wasn't restraining himself, we'd just get swallowed back up into the whole, you know, we'd dive into the sun and perish.
It's interesting that phrase at the bottom, enabled to perceive itself to be an entity, the very grace of God enables us to view ourselves.
Yes.
The fiction that anyone can say, life and God, strong in our mind that we are in that.
Yes, it is.
And the very fact that they don't spell out the name of God,
well, that's, don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. That means don't write it, don't ever use it. Yeah, that's all Jewish writings. They will never fill in the name of God. It is beyond the scope of the mind of any creature to comprehend the essential nature of the Tzimtzum and concealment, and to comprehend that nonetheless, the Tzimtzum notwithstanding, the creature itself be created ex nihilo. Now, of course, you say, okay, that sounds pretty complicated, but let's face it, give me a good explanation of the Trinity. You know, give me a good explanation of Jesus as God and human. We're talking about very profound concepts that Christians also study to get, also struggle to get their minds around. These are things beyond us in many ways, and we have our own struggles with these kind of deep concepts about the nature of God and who Christ actually was and what the nature of his, you know, the two aspects of his existence were. We'll talk more about that next time, but I just thought while this seems very speculative, if you look into the Christian literature, there's plenty of speculation about that sort of thing as well. And that's basically the Kabbalistic solution, right? The Tzimtzum is how the world exists. God has had to put up this magnetic field around himself so that he can dial down the power to dial up other aspects. It's an interesting attempt. And I think it does highlight aspects that exist. And of course, Jesus is in many ways the ultimate expression of Tzimtzum, which is what I want to talk about next time. You know, because when, you know, Philip said, you know, show me the Father. Is it Philip? Yes. He was, you know, confronted with this very strange statement. You're looking at him, you know. So obviously something really strange is happening there. But we won't go on to that right now. Of course, the whole creation reflects this principle. And I've spent quite a few talks looking at this. You know, every aspect of creation is designed to keep all these aspects in balance. Space-time is a great invention, right? Somehow it manages to keep this separate from this. Two can coexist in the same universe. Separates them. It creates room for both to do their thing. We're not that far away. Feel it. Every day you get up in the morning, there's this big thing up there, but it's far enough away so that all this rich, gentle existence that we have on the Earth is nothing like happening here. And of course, space and time are very useful in so many other ways. In every way, I mean. Thank goodness we live in Australia and not in some of the very difficult parts of the world, which are constantly at war and, you know, where all sorts of terrible tragedies are happening. Just a few thousand miles of separation allow totally different environments to exist in very close proximity to each other. Whereas if there was no differentiation, like if God, you know, probably you would imagine God's, okay, I'm going to create the universe now. What's the first thing I need? Space-time. That's the first thing I'm going to put in place. I've got to start separating things. I can't just have everything all together. You can't put this together with this. It just won't work. And on a much more human scale, you know, you look at the big periods of history. Thank goodness the Atlantic Ocean separated Europe and America. You know, we needed that separation to keep different systems going, different political systems going. All sorts of things happen because space-time exists. You can't run the world without it.
Well, the structure is in Genesis 1. The first 3 days are all about the separation.
It is, yeah, separation. Separation. And this is also, I think, a very big part of Tzimtzum. You know, if you want to have a sophisticated operating system, you have to keep separating. You can't just have one homogeneous mess. Well, it's not a mess, it's just one homogeneous substance. You have to keep refining it, dividing it. And that's what the creation is all about, you know, increasingly more and more differentiated and sophisticated entities that produce these complex structures that can act as operating systems for very profound things. Relativity, I mean, I've spoken about relativity, LSD is a fascinating thing because these are what's called light current. I've had this up before, and I'm talking about relativity, but basically this is time. Time on the sex, space on the sex. That's what it means, of course, is that what it means is you can't, if events are separated by a certain distance or a certain time, that can never influence goodness. So our past cannot, nothing from our past can intrude into our current life. Whatever happened in history will never be able, because of the way space-time is set up, everything has to happen in cause and effect. Events happen, they become in the past, they can no longer intrude into the future. The events that happen outside our light cone, which light, the light cone basically represents that aspect of space-time from our point can be reached by a light beam. So that means that's the past, any event influences us. If it's within that, it can influence, but there's of course a vast area in time and space and never affect. I'm not going to go any further into that, but suffice to say it's another differentiator. It's another way of organising the world. It's at the fundamental level. And we don't think about these things. We use them, you know, we're happy to act and live in this operating system, this very complex, sophisticated operating system. We enjoy its benefits, but it's nice to stop and think occasionally, what a great system, you know, what an amazing system it is.
It lets us be. Without this, we couldn't be.
It couldn't be. That's right. If all these things, if all these things weren't differentiated, we'd just get swallowed up into the, you know, the all-consuming Godhead. Here's another interesting thought, which I brought up on Star Wars world does not exist. It exists in the movies, but relativity, basically, we are a very local phenomenon. We can't travel. Nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, which pretty much limits us to the sun and its general surrounding environment in the solar system. For us to travel to the nearest star, it would take minimum 4 years. Travel to the edge of the galaxy, you're talking 50 or 100,000 years. It all becomes very silly and speculative, Star Wars notwithstanding. And I think that's a very interesting, and the universe, of course, is immensely, and that's a galaxy is just a little blip, a little pinpoint in the vastness of the universe. But that in itself is a tsimtsum, it's a limitation. And this will become important, I hope, as we go on a little further, because what is about to be introduced into the whole system, that is a very interesting website, by the way, if you want to play around with that, scaleoftheuniverse.com. Because I think God has limited us to the Earth in this day for a very good reason. He's not going to let what happens here migrate into the rest of the age. All his current sophistication and plans are happening right there. It's like a containment mechanism. And the point you made, Tony, so he's separating, right? He's separating all the way through Genesis, separating, differentiating. He's making it more and more complex so that he can build up more and more sophisticated systems for us. But he's basically, it says in Psalm 115, the highest heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth he has given to mankind. So he's created this incredibly sophisticated operating system, and then he's, of course, the real game is about to start. What we've been discussing is, of course, just the groundwork. The action hasn't started yet. The curtain hasn't been raised. The actor hasn't come on the stage. Hamlet hasn't appeared yet. It's all been prepared for him. The props have been done. The script's been written. But we're waiting for the curtain to rise and Hamlet to appear. Oh, I won't go on to that. I think, you know, this is just, it's all been prepared. In this very, I put in a Gerard Manley Hopkins poem there for you, Tony.
Thanks.
How amazing, you know, the world is, da 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 da. But amazing as the physical creation is, Hamlet, that's what we're waiting for. Where is he? There he is. And he's put into a very controlled environment. So we've got the control, and the Earth is a controlled environment. It's very difficult to get off the Earth, right? The amount of energy you have to expand to get into space is quantum leaps above any other energy requirement we have. And then once we get out there, relativity is going to limit us. So whatever's going to take place in this age of the universe, the way physics is set up, it's all going to take place here on the Earth. It's interesting to speculate that physics will, in the next age, possibly be changed. Relativity may be lifted. We might be able to zip over to Alpha Centauri without too much trouble. But in this age, it's not going to happen. It's all going to be played out here on the Earth. But it's all started in an even more enclosed environment, and that was, of course, the Garden of Eden. Now, whatever your view is on whether the Garden of Eden was a real place or not, I think we can speculate a lot about what the point God is trying to make in his account of the Garden of Eden. Let's just read what I think is some key passages. Now the Lord God had planted a garden in the east, in Eden, and there he put the man he had formed. The Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. In the middle of the garden were the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. And the Lord God commanded the man, "You are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. For when you eat from it, you will certainly die." This has always bothered me, this account. Why on earth didn't God erect a huge fence around the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Enormous red flashing signs. Do not enter. Stay away. Electrify the whole thing. It's just almost, it seems almost flippant, almost casual. And he sort of walks away. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And then he sort of walks away, and then, of course, what's going to happen? We're waiting for the next act, and of course it does. And then the consequence, death. So we always spec. I think we read that as saying the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is bad. Your punishment for eating it is death. You've completely stuffed the whole thing up. It's all an absolute disaster. But I'd like to propose a slightly different view. I think these represent two aspects of two fundamental aspects of God and his character and personality. And that for us to be image bearers, we have to learn to cope with both. That in itself represents, before Adam ate it, he was innocent. He was like a child. He had to be introduced into this whole other found world. And of course, we focus on the evil, really, sin. We read that as sin. Whereas I think this is the path to really. And it's creating a dichotomy because I think it's trying to explore that aspect of creation, which is to do with mind, you know, all the sophistication that comes with being God and human. You know, if you think back to the Exodus account, you can see God wrestling with these very opposing and profound issues. You know, the Israelites, I want them, but they can't come too close. You know, I want to go with them, but if I do, I'll consume them in a minute. You know, all these kind of very difficult and sophisticated problems that it is to be God and human, and we, of course, are entering into all those kind of issues. Our problem is we ate it early, and we didn't know what to do. And we still don't, really. But I think in order to be occupiers of eternity, which is, I think, what life, this life is the preparation and the school for occupiers of eternity, which is, of course, us. And for us to be occupiers of eternity, we have to come to terms with both. Let's explore that a little further. I'm so conscious of time.
Yeah, but just clarify, it's like eternity not released out of the created world, including the eternal created world, will continue in concealment.
Yes, although I think the concealment is successively lifted. Like in the next age, there'll be less concealment, right? But to progress to that next stage, we have to experience this age where this whole thing has been exposed. We're out of the garden. The garden was like the first little microcosm. Then we're roaming the earth, where it's like, you know, I hate to say virus because I know, you know, it's probably not a very, but you know, it's breached the containment. You know, what are we going to do about it? And I think what happens is, of course, before I say that, I just want to focus on these. It's the journey from innocence to wisdom. That's what I think we need. That's what the human experience is all about. It's the journey from innocence to wisdom. And that is, I think wisdom is the fundamental aspect of God's character, and it's the one he wants us to enter into. And you can't have wisdom if you're innocent. You know, you have to be exposed to... It's no use for God to have concealed that tree from us. We would have had to confront it at some stage. We would have had to face it head on, because he does. To create a sophisticated world, all those aspects have to be revealed and come to light. A child has to grow up into an adult. And we don't do that very well, often. We don't do it as well as we could. God, of course, has brought in a lot of things to help us. He hasn't just let us go on our merry way, although there was an aspect of history where he did that, and we'll come to that in a minute. But let's just have a look quickly at a few of the comments made. God himself said, "The man has now become like us, knowing good and evil." So God, he says, it's an essential aspect of becoming like me that you know good and evil. It seems to imply that. The serpent, I know you can't trust anything the serpent says, but he says, "For God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil." The woman says, the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom. Now, these are all comments. These are actually the only comments that are made about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Really good and evil?
I think that's a very good question, and one that I think the real, perhaps, meaning of what that is has been lost over thousands of years of legalistic interpretations of that verse. You know, we immediately, Tony and Mark have spoken a lot about that we've actually created this thing into
it. Because of the original sin, you actually change the whole.
Yes, yeah.
Knowledge of it.
I think that's a good way of putting it. Yes, a knowledge of a mature knowledge of what the world's really like, what the world is capable of, and it's you know from one end of the spectrum to the other, and we're of course immersed in that. You know, it's very you can't be a human adult without just plunging right into this messy, complicated whirlwind that we call life, with so many aspects to it, so many differing, you know, some things that we feel are wonderful, other things we feel are really bad. I didn't want to use the word evil. And a whole spectrum in between. We see it in other people, we see it in ourselves. When we're introspective, we notice all this kind of, we're on this huge continuum all the time, dealing with this very sophisticated and profound human aspect. You know, our minds are things that are creating all sorts of paradoxical, profound experiences in us. Yes.
There's something about the garden of Eden that is tied up, and I don't know what it's. What happened is Superman were out, then sent out into the big world. But up to that point, didn't want us in the big, because we've known it. There's something about, because if you talk about, you know, the land, here there wasn't a separation. I mean, okay, there must have been, even at that stage, had the garden of Eden and outside, and we weren't allowed inside the same way as we were allowed.
Yes, but as soon as we had, our eyes were opened, rather than saying eaten of the tree, I think our eyes were opened, you know, to that aspect of the world that is moral and many other things. So, nice. You know, this is us before, this is us after. Our eyes are open. And I think, you know, a lot of the complications of the world comes basically now. We're all little dots, basically, little king, trying to deal with this very sophisticated and profound experience that we call life. Everyone becomes a little epicenter of ambition, activity, experience. We all interact in a very messy way with each other. I don't want to use the word sin. I mean, I think this is just a natural aspect of the fact that we've all been released into the world with these kind of difficult issues that we're dealing with in what we call life. And Judges is a nice little verse. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. It's, you know, nice picture of what it's like out in the world. You know, you're out of the garden, now everybody's operating kind of under those circumstances. Of course, I think Israel, and particularly Jesus, is bringing all this back under control. But without it, that's how the world operates. And a lot of the world operates like that. And, you know, I don't know how many of you watch television, but most of them, all of these shows and plays, and fortunately this fellow, explored all this complexity of life that we now experience. We're all immersed in it, obviously not as profoundly as these people, hopefully, but even just bringing it down to earth and making it real, I come back to the family situation. It's such a complex and deeply profound experience to be part of a family. You have to operate in all these very sophisticated kind of checks and balances, seemingly paradoxical. You know, there's love there, there's duty, there's care, there's sometimes strictness if you're a parent. You know, all these things are operating for you constantly. And interestingly, the fruits of the Spirit seem to line up quite nicely with the love, joy, forbearance, kindness, goodness, self-control. All aspects of God's character that bring everything back in balance. This is where we're going next week. Of course, Jesus demonstrated this aspect of God's character perfectly, and that's what he calls us, of course, to bring into our lives, to stop that, you know. And that's how we learn to deal with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I don't want to go on too much longer, I think, because I think we're all getting tired. But one thing I will say is, actually, there's not many slides to go, I think, so I'll just finish up quickly. Death. Let's talk about death for a minute. Death is not a punishment, I don't think. Death is the fail-safe. You know, the dead man's switch. When everything else fails, that's the one that operates. So these are nice little the Lord in Genesis 6, you know, when he's just before the flood, the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. Lucky Hitler couldn't live more than a certain amount of time. You know, it's the fail-safe. It doesn't allow the momentum to build up. Once you've got good and evil, they're not, once you've got your eyes are opened, once human beings' eyes are opened, it can get, I mean, Tony did a very nice talk on it a year or so ago. What is it? Synecdoche? Is that what? Leverage? Leverage is fine when it's in the hands of good people, but in the hands of bad people, you got to have the fail-safe there. You got to shut them down after a while. You can let them go so far, but then death kicks in and it shuts it off. Psalm 37, I think, picks that out nicely. "I have seen a wicked and a ruthless man flourishing like a luxuriant native tree, but he soon passed away and was no more. Though I looked for him, he could not be found." And I think that's the function. You know, we've convinced ourselves that death is the punishment, but I think it's the necessary fail-safe in this age to keep everything from blowing out of control. Of course, it wasn't always like that. There was a period where God let it just run riot, and that was the pre-diluvian period, the period before the flood. And I think there's two aspects to that. One is, it's clear that human beings, it implies that God had no contact whatsoever with the human race, except for a very, very limited line down through to Noah. In Genesis 4, after Cain had murdered Abel, Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. He went out of the Lord's presence. And then, of course, Romans 1 goes on and on, but I've just picked up these two verses. "Furthermore, just as they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, so God gave them over to a depraved mind so that they do what ought not to be done. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity." And in Genesis 6, "The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them." He basically activated this fail-safe mechanism with the flood, you know. He withdrew, and I think the aspect in that pre-diluvian period where humans seem to have been very long-lived is to give, they had a dual combination. God withdrew to see what would happen, in a sense, and he gave them this very long life, which almost simulated eating, you know, eternal life as well. So if you mix the two, the pre-diluvian period is almost like having the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the tree, still having them, giving them access to the tree of life. And if you live 1,000 years, whether you believe that or not, let's just imagine the imagery. They had a long time to coexist with both their own egocentric view of the world, and there was no fail-safe. Yeah, you understand what I mean by that? Mm. We'll talk about this more. I'll just briefly mention it on the way through. The Tower of Babel, interesting. That's, of course, after the flood, I think after the flood, God said, I'll never do that again. I'm not going to let it just all go to rack and ruin. Now I'm going to start acting in the world. I'm going to start bringing the balance back, showing you how to handle this mess that you call life. I'm going to start educating you. We're going to start bringing it back. And interesting, I mean, this is a very interesting little event, Tower of Babel. It's the first thing, first intervention of God after the flood. And it's always, you know, what on earth is going on there? You know. But I think it's an act of tzimtzum, you know. God is constraining and restraining, just like death is a fail-safe mechanism. By dividing the languages, God has limited how one particular society can no longer dominate the whole earth. So, you know, when Hitler went to war, you had America across the Atlantic operating under a totally different system. The synecdoche could not get out of hand. Well, once God confused the languages, you had little microcosms of society, not only microcosms of individuals. So each individual, you know, there are people that we say are good, there are people we say are bad, there are people who we say that live good lives and bad lives. Same with societies, you know. We make differentiation between societies, and I think that is a tool that God uses to keep the world from descending back into the era of the flood, before the flood. And of course, the law is given. We'll talk more about that later. And I'll just finish off by saying, of course, the ultimate symptom is Jesus. He's got a certificate of compliance. He knows how to operate with both the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And just as a teaser and maybe to try and demonstrate that fact. I've just picked out a few verses there. Hebrews 4:15, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weak, but we have one who has been tempted in every way just as we are, yet he did not sin. Operating with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, Jesus was operating with it all the time. But of course, on the other hand, in Hebrews 7, and what we have said is even more clear if another priest like Melchizedek appears, one who has become a priest not on the basis of a regulation as to his ancestry, but on the basis of the power of an indestructible life. For it is declared, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So Jesus keeps both these trees in perfect balance. Both he demonstrated what it is to be truly human, and to be truly human you need to be able to deal with both aspects. And of course, finally, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Jesus represents the ultimate expression of the wisdom of God. I think that's enough. I hope I haven't sprouted too much heresy. But I welcome comments or criticisms.
So foreshadowing this idea of the positive of the cross, which is essentially going to be in a sense seems the some deep mystery of the nature of how God operates in the world observed in the cross.
Yes, the cross, it's the cross of Jesus that is the fundamentally important thing. God contracted himself to such an extent that he allowed the complete depowering, I suppose, of himself on the cross. The ultimate power was completely depowered on the cross, and that released all sorts of profound consequences. Profoundly positive consequences. Yeah.
Some pathway for us.
Yes. Yeah. I'm sure. Well, love is definitely wrapped up. I think that's the motivator. Yes. That's the motivator. Ultimately, you would suppose that love is the motivator for everything that God has done in creation.
Jesus seems to be aware of that from time to time. He's almost holding back and says, don't you know that my Father, I could implore my Father to intervene.
Exactly.
He always says, he's got the brakes on.
The brakes.
He's all the time, I was going to go into draw out all those sort of passages next time, looking at the life of Jesus in quite a bit of detail, actually, because Tony suggested I read Tom Wright in preparation for this, who is very good on some of these aspects, and in his point is very much that that Jesus was king of the universe and could have acted in all sorts of powerful ways. He never did. He was constantly restraining himself. You can think of so many aspects of his life, whether it's like the miracles. If you think about the miracles of Jesus, if it was you or me, those pesky Romans or Pharisees would have got a little bit of a flick, just would have zapped them. But no, all his miracles were just about healing, stilling the waves, casting out demons. Tremendous restraint.
He was active in this, not passive. He had to himself, restrain himself from calling down the angels and so on.
Yes, yes.
So it wasn't done to him, he was active.
He was, yes, yes.
Even to like telling
yes.
He didn't want them to go off.
No, that's right. Yes. Yep. But anyway.
And I think to just keep sort of shouting, think this through, because where we began was saying, I guess what we take a view of the cross tends to be locked very much in cause and effect, picture of the world, and it doesn't sort of fit in, and yet cross seems to be continually referred back to as an operating principle by Paul and others.
Yes.
In Revelation, Jesus remains the Lamb of God.
That's right.
Something enduring positive and about it, because I think the whole point about Tom's book, which I love, is actually the title that did it all for me, which is When God the King. Because what we saw in that is, I thought it was so profound, those tenfold type structures they had of Zim Zum, the outcome was kingship.
Right, yes.
And that God was not king in this, God was not king of this order without ultimately cross.
Yes.
And so kind of Zim Zum is the only way to rule in this order.
That's it.
Whereas what we're thinking is the way to rule in this order would be the kind of obliterating, all consuming, why doesn't God do this type of power? And so I break all the rules of that happens,
yes,
no obligation, there's nothing.
That's right, yeah.
Beginning to see why the cross, particularly when it's linked to the resurrection, dead.
Yes, yes. They lead directly, one leads directly to the other.
Yeah.
It's interesting that there's, you see, in both things, you've purely done.
Yes, yeah.
But what Christ.
Yes. Yes. It's the valley of the shadow of death. It's not, you know, the end, is it? For us, death is the beginning of something better. Mm. Yes. Except if it's the second death. That's true.
Well, thanks a lot. Okay. I know that a lot of years college anywhere else because of yours privilege is some of this stuff boundary. I was saying to Drew that I haven't watched this, but they probably will do it. Probably we'll try and get something either last week of November, first week of December to take this one forward again.
Okay, yeah, that'd be good. Thank you. How do I switch on this?